This is Wage World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me on the east side of town?
This is Wade Brasky, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points north and south, east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org and acornradio.org. A podcast will be available to the show on these websites and at www.affiliatedmediamovement.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Randy Shaw, a fellow organizer and longtime comrade who's written yet another new book, and it's a great one, Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in New Urban America. Welcome to Wade's World, Randy.
Thanks, Wade, for having me.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. We've done about 300 of these shows, and I think you and one other are about the only people I've been on twice, Randy. So, you know, after Katrina, it was sort of embarrassing when people would call us disaster experts. That's not something you look to be. And now with this book, people will know how much of an expert you are on gentrification, which is, we need that, but that's hardly what you want on your, resume, is it?
Well, it's what's really happened, Wade, over particularly the last 5 or 6, 7 years since the economy recovered after the crash of 2007 and 2008, is that in the major cities, the progressive cities across America, people who used to be able to, the working and middle class, no longer can afford to live there. I mean, unionized janitors, unionized hotel workers have always lived in places like San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, Portland. Now they've been priced out, and that's what my book addresses, is how we can deal with that crisis of the working and middle class being priced out of the cities they built.
And it's happening everywhere. I know there's a chapter in your book about Austin. We've had an office there. I've been going in and out of Austin as often as I have San Francisco over the last 50 years, and swear to God, Randy, it's twice as big. There's only one road through it, and I have a friend who's a lawyer, former organizer, says his retirement is trying to get his law firm to sell the building because it's worth like $2.5 million now, and they bought it for like, $200,000.
Well, I didn't know about your connection to Austin because you may remember there was a movie made in 1994 called Slacker by Richard Linklater, and it was about all the 20-somethings who didn't really have regular jobs, used to hang around Austin. Well, they couldn't make that movie today because if you don't have a full-time, high-paid job, you can't afford to live in Austin anymore.
Well,
it's been a completely transformed city.
There's a lot of it that's happening in New Orleans now post-Katrina. We're, the
yep.
thing about the farmers, we're now land rich and dirt poor. If your daddy didn't buy the farm, you lost it back in the late 70s in that recession. Tell us how it's working in San Francisco. You've been directing the Tenderloin Housing Clinic. I've visited with you many times. It's an amazing thing what you all have done there. But you're sort of ground zero in the heart of the cutting edge of the disaster, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Tenderloin, interesting enough, where I've worked since 1980, and I have a book on the called The Tenderloin, The Sex, Crime, and Resistance in the Heart of San Francisco, about how we stop the gentrification of the Tenderloin, but that's the only neighborhood that's true about in San Francisco. And what I describe in the book is everyone knows, San Francisco has been an expensive city like New York City for a long time, not like most of the cities I write about, Seattle, Portland, Austin, more recent. And what I describe is really how local policies have contributed to the exclusion of the working and middle class. I mean, San Francisco is notorious. It just doesn't build housing. Great for the existing homeowners, the neighborhoods that have every house goes for $2 million because they don't let anything get built, but not real good for a new generation trying to live in the city. And that phenomenon has been repeated in other cities where we have, you know, older homeowners who just say, I don't want any apartments built in my neighborhood. Well, that means you're not going to have affordable anything affordable, right?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, I think I shared with you a bunch of work some the Yale Architecture School did. We had a former volunteer who'd worked on it. Their proposals were wild. They wanted to build on top of parking lots, build on top of streets, on streetcar lines. I mean, because land is also a problem in terms of the cost in places like San Francisco, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, what's really interesting is even in places like Austin where there's plenty of land, you drive around Austin, you could build 100,000 units, you wouldn't even miss it, but there'd be plenty of vacant land still. There's just this view of people who already have their house and are very content with the situation, and they don't want any more, and even though they don't mind people commuting, driving greenhouse gas emissions up through long commutes, because traffic is like horrible in all these cities, as you probably know, people commuting from outside the city because they can't afford to live in. There was a report done recently, 120,000 people commute every day, an hour and a half from Sacramento, the state capital, to the Bay Area for their jobs. 120,000 people a day are driving an hour and a half each way.
We could tell that story. I had a former guy work for us in Dallas who got a job in Venice, California, which is, you know, in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
First move out there, he was having to live 80 miles away. And
well, wait,
for
someone
three
you
years,
work with,
he was driving, you know, almost an hour, 45 minutes each way to get to work and back.
Well, someone you used to work with who was a mutual friend of ours, Jerry Jones.
Sure.
He commutes an hour to work. He and his wife commute an hour to work.
I swear to God, I'd kill myself, Randy. I mean, my commute to the office, and you know, and this is a classic story, is about 3.5-4 minutes. It depends on whether or not the train comes through, you know?
Well, you know what's interesting, Wade? There was a period of time, people our, you know, age, we had the option of living close to our work if we chose because there were affordable options.
Exactly.
And this is what my Generation Priced Out is all about, is that this new generation, all these millennials coming out with like $100,000 in college debt, which we didn't have, right? They have this huge college debt, and then they're confronted with really high housing costs, and we're not doing anything to make it more affordable for them. And that's just a terrible mistake, and it's unfair to the future generations of the working and middle class. The future generations of the wealthy are fine, right, because they'll get all those housing, but that's not what cities are supposed to be about.
The Federal Reserve recently did a report on exactly your point, worried about the student loan debt depressing the entire housing market. But you made an interesting point about how people are blocking the building of housing. It's not just policymakers.
Yeah, it's the biggest problem.
As a community organizer of the chapter, How Neighborhood Groups Stop Housing, you sort of, I don't know if I want to really read that chapter. But
well, I think community organizing groups have fought, you know, destructive projects that they felt would gentrify neighborhoods. But what we find is, and this is what the common thread in almost all of the so-called progressive cities, is that they all have powerful neighborhood groups that stop apartments from being built in their neighborhood. And
Right. When
you ban apartments from your neighborhood, you know, people are going to be surprised to hear this because San Francisco is known as a big tenant town. Over half of the buildable land in San Francisco, you can only build a mansion. You cannot build a fourplex. Does that make any sense?
No,
a city that promotes
like
inclusion
that
and claims they care about diversity, you only let mansions be built?
And how do they define that? Is that square footage, value of the price?
Density. They limit it to one unit per lot. This is what they did in Austin. In Austin, after the GI Bill passed, they were afraid that African Americans might move to Austin, so they made a huge minimum lot size
right.
So the GI Bill couldn't be used.
Now, it used to be for a while, and you live on the other side of the bay from the, you know, Emerald City of San Francisco, that you could still find affordable housing in places like Oakland, but that's not true anymore either, is it?
No, and that's what led me to write the book, because after the December 2nd, 2016 ghost ship fire where 36 young people died at a illegal artist live work warehouse, it just dawned on me that what has happened, that it used to be you could always afford Oakland.
Yeah.
Now you can't, and rents in Oakland, people are going to be shocked if they check the online and go online what rents are in Oakland, they're not going to believe it compared to where it was even 5 years ago. There's been a higher percentage rent increases in Oakland than San Francisco.
Yeah, I did a study on that recently. We're talking to Randy Shaw, a longtime tenant expert, organizer, runs the Tenderloin Legal Clinic, but he's also written a new book called Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in New Urban America. You went around the country to look at some of these situations firsthand in doing this book, didn't you, Randy?
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. I grew up in Los Angeles, and yet I wrote about places I had never went to when I grew up in there, and Boyle Heights and Highland Park. And one of the things I think your listeners should think about, because some people might be listening and saying, well, I don't really have to worry about gentrification. We don't have that problem here. But that's what they said in Highland Park. And in the space of 5 years, it completely transformed. Boyle Heights, no one ever imagined. It's a low-income Latino neighborhood for 50, 60 years. No one imagined. If I said to you 5 years ago, Wade, you should be prepared about gentrification in Boyle Heights, you'd say I was crazy. But it happens very quickly, and it can just take one, you know, you can take Oracle coming into your neighborhood, buying land, and suddenly your whole real estate market's changed. So you have to take preventative measures, and that's what I discuss in the book.
Well, and I want to get to that, but you mentioned Oracle, and this was a question I'd written down as well. So Microsoft just got a huge amount of publicity, committing to $500 million to ostensibly, you know, impact the housing crisis in Seattle. Give me your take on that.
Well, one thing is, none of the money is going to Seattle. It's going
to suburbs.
And some of the suburbs like Bellevue are like cities, so it's not like it's just set the traditional suburb. And I should caution that it is a loan, the $500 million. I mean, but nevertheless, I think, you know, for me, we've been trying to get private corporations to contribute to the housing market for decades, and they haven't been willing to. And what it really shows is the middle class is now affected by it. And as you know, Wade, when it's just low-income people and working people affected by a problem, we can all ignore it, right?
Yeah.
But once it hits the middle class, it's time to act, and I think that's what's happening.
As more and more families realize their children will never be able to live in the cities where they've grown up, and they're all going to put dirt in our faces, that's going to be a problem. But Facebook also claims, and you know, that they're doing something in San Francisco. What's the story there?
Yeah, Facebook announced it's their foundation, the Chan Zuckerberg Foundation, which announced $40 million. They had a big announcement yesterday. And look, this is all good. I mean, you know, I'm not out there. I know there are some people who are very cynical and say it's still the government's responsibility. Of course, it's still the government's responsibility. But some of us have been waiting. Since Reagan demolished the HUD budget in 1981, we've never gotten that money back.
Yeah.
So that's about 38 years we've waited for the federal government to step up. And at some point, you have to say, let's look for alternatives while we're still pushing the government to step up. So the private sector has to step up because their own employees are affected. And while no one is saying that they're a substitute, we need their commitment. And Gavin Newsom, new governor of California, says he pledged in first week of January to raise $500 million for the private sector, separate from this money. So whatever we can get, it helps.
Well, and it's still better for Zuckerberg Chan to be putting money into housing than more charter schools. So
I was going to say, better than the $100 million they threw away in New Jersey on educational studies.
Yeah, there's some people in Newark who are probably thankful for that, but they're all long gone. They made their consulting contracts, and it's all in their way. So where do you – let's talk about you offer 10 steps to – you know, the last chapter, the conclusion, you offer some – recommendations.
Well, the number one thing that every city should do is use their publicly owned land for affordable housing. Because we hear so often, well, there's no place to build affordable housing. Well, there's public land, and I write in the book about a terrible situation that occurred in Crown Heights in a gentrifying part of New York City in Brooklyn, where you had an African American Latino neighborhood that's being gentrified, and there was a big armory. A block size that could have been a tremendous resource for affordable housing, and the so-called progressive mayor Bill de Blasio decided he wanted to build luxury condos.
I know exactly
because
that.
On public
I know
land.
That location. Exactly right. Well,
and
yeah.
And see, even in, I mean, so, I mean, cities have to use their public land for affordable housing. And if that, that, and that becomes the bulwark against gentrification. And in Boyle Heights, they are starting to acquire, and L.A. passed a bond. So if you don't build affordable housing when you have the opportunity, you can't complain when private market rate comes in and buys the land because someone's going to buy it. So you have to preempt. We did in the Tenderloin. So much of my Tenderloin neighborhood was acquired by nonprofit corporations that when we had another boom, 40% of our neighborhood was off the speculative market. It wasn't even affected because it's already owned by nonprofits.
Well, and that's so important. But, you know, the New York, the Brooklyn situation is one I know probably even better than San Francisco. But, you know, when the Atlantic Yards development where the vault, the Nets play and whatever, you know, we negotiated a community benefits agreement for 2,400 affordable units of housing. Oh, my God, Randy, that was so controversial among people who wanted not affordable housing, but nothing to happen. And it's not like Bloomberg wasn't going to allow a development into Hudson Yards. And if you can't get affordable housing out of it, you're going to get nothing. But and obviously, we weathered the storm, but gee, I mean, it's difficult for some people to understand that for our communities to survive, they have to have working people, they have to have lower-income families, they have to have middle-income housing.
One thing that I've learned since writing Generation Talking Out, Priced Out, and doing all these talks and everything, you start realizing that there are a lot of people who live in cities who really want to live in a suburb, and that means they don't want anything built over three stories. They want a single-family home with a picket fence and everyone having a lawn. And that's not what cities historically are, but that's what they want the city to be. And so they ban apartments. They want it to be suburbia. And it doesn't work. And that's what we're fighting. And I think we're having success. I mean, city after city, Minneapolis broke through on single-family zoning. And you know, you have all these cities where you have vast stretches of land. You can only build a single-family home or a mansion. We're making progress on that, and I've been very optimistic about how things are moving along as this book's come out in November. So even since November, we've seen a lot of progress.
Well, and that's a good point. It's worth us looking at how many of those single-family covenants and restrictions still exist. I mean, in the neighborhood where I live, I mean, since Katrina, we've had huge gentrification in the areas that didn't flood, and what used to be working class, mixed neighborhood. I mean, when we moved into the neighborhood where we live in Bywater, New Orleans, it was, you know, a third white, a third Latino, and a third black. Now it's 70% white after Katrina.
And you know what people often, that same is true with areas of Berkeley and Oakland, but what many think that the big villain is some giant luxury development that comes in, but actually it's the changing hands of single-family homes with new, more affluent buyers either tearing down and building a bigger building on a house on the same lot or more upscale luxury house. So in many neighborhoods, that have been, the most common gentrification method is just the turnover of properties and the upgrading of them. And if we built apartments in those neighborhoods, there'd be more economic diversity. But we have every city I write about in the book, all the cities, Denver, Seattle, Portland, Minneapolis, Austin, have vast stretches of the city that you cannot build an apartment. And that has to change. And progressives need to get behind that. We're talking about a Green New Deal. You can't have a Green New Deal without green zoning. And that means zoning so people can live in cities and not have to commute an hour.
Well, and apartments needs to be defined as differently than market price condos and mixed developments. I mean, we had an old meatpacking plant is literally in a block next to me. And there was a fight about how high it was going to go because it turned out what they wanted to do was build condominiums, which were original plan from the developers. They were all going to sell 400,000 plus. Well, in New Orleans? I mean, who has those jobs?
People often say to me, well, isn't the problem that the housing they're building is all luxury housing downtown? And I say, right, because they're not allowed to build anywhere else. All of our cities that I talk about, including San Francisco, allow, you know, 25 to 30 story luxury condos to be built in the downtown area, but that doesn't do anything for our housing crisis. We need to let housing, we need fourplexes in the neighborhoods.
We're talking to Randy Shaw, who's written a new book that underlines some of the prospects and impacts of gentrification called Generation Priced Out, Who Gets to Live in the New Urban America. There's a lot of talk about, zoning that will force these kinds of developments to have affordable housing. What's your experience there? And as you travel, what did you see good?
Well, one of the major recommendations I have in Generation Priced Out is what's called inclusionary housing, where developers,
exactly,
private developers, are required to have a percentage of their units affordable. And one of the reasons that's just so very important is all these gentrified neighborhoods we're talking about, the only way a working-class person can get into those neighborhoods is if it's through this inclusionary housing. But if the neighborhood is banning any development, there's no opportunities for those. So it's really, people often say to me, well, how can you support that because only 20% is affordable? And I say, well, for those 20% of people, that's a great life opportunity. That's better than zero.
Exactly. Although sometimes the problem, and we see this in London particularly, is when they all of a sudden say affordable housing is, you know, a certain percentage of average rents. All of a sudden, what used to be affordable is also for millionaires. I mean,
I think, you know, there's a lot of controversy about the word affordable, but I mean, in the actual practical experience in a city like San Francisco, the vast majority of affordable housing goes to people at like 60% of area median. It's not going to people who are, it's going to people, working people, and middle, not even middle class. So they're the primary beneficiaries. But, you know, you'd be surprised. Los Angeles does not have inclusionary housing. Oakland is having thousands of units come on, and they have no inclusionary housing because they're all afraid, well, it'll kill the development. Well, when those projects all open in Oakland, this is a city that is very focused on keeping their African-American population, you'll see how few African-Americans are in those units. And then everyone's going to wonder, why didn't we do inclusionary? Well, you blew it.
Yeah, well, and how do they select people? Is it application, lottery? I know
lottery.
In New York City, lottery. Why isn't that more popular? Because that's been successful in New York and some other city, hasn't it?
Well, it's interesting. What would really help minority populations is neighborhood preference, so that if a project is built, like for affordable housing in an African-American neighborhood, shouldn't the people in that neighborhood have preference? And our mayor of San Francisco, London Breed, has really fought for preference. Interesting enough, HUD has always been against it because they say it's discriminatory.
Well, and I hate to think what Dr. Carson would say about anything that had
right.
to do. But, I mean, he probably
right.
thinks there ought to be affirmative action for white people to move in.
He probably does.
Yeah, because it would raise the standard somehow.
Yeah.
But that's interesting because, you know, we've always fought on those developments for preference in hiring. Preference for
local hire.
Residents would
right.
also be important.
Right.
And are people winning that in some cities now?
Well, it was a whole big thing that our former Mayor Lee, and when London Breed was a supervisor, they fought mm-hmm. for, because she saw all of her African-American friends not being able to ever get any of the units that were being built, supposedly, to keep diversity, and they're having to leave the city. And so she's still working on it, but there's just this unfortunate view. They don't, like I say, local hire, everyone's in favor of, most people are in favor of it. But neighborhood preference and affordable housing, it becomes, other issues get involved. And so what it means is that
we could get traction on that, because if there's nothing, I mean, a politician knows if the demographics change, they're not going to get reelected, particularly in largely Latino or African-American areas. I would think that we might be able to get that through in some places now that you're giving us the pointers here.
I'm hoping for that because, you know, every city that I write about in Generation Priced Out publicly claims, these are not conservative cities. These are cities that claim,
exactly,
we want diversity, we want more inclusion. So why don't you have policies to further those goals instead of reversing those goals? That's why I wrote this book, because I just didn't understand why all these progressive cities are doing the wrong thing. I mean, that just doesn't make sense.
Well, the day it makes sense, and you talk about housing developers, those don't go in the same conversations. I mean, the problem with developers is they get in, they get out. What do they care?
Well, I would say the question is, when you have someone in New York City like Mayor de Blasio, who gets elected with completely elected the first time with African-American Latino support, who went to Crown Heights, these tenants were all walking precincts for him. Then he becomes mayor, and he tells Crown Heights, I'm building luxury condos on your public land. Does that make sense to you? I mean, that's just, this is the problem we get with some of these so-called progressive politicians selling out to real estate.
Well, and Mayor de Blasio is paying some prices for that. Some of the support he had then has definitely disappeared. Denver, I spent some time in Denver several times last year. Boy, that's a city that's changing. But I went through one area that we used to organize in, community college near there, and huge developments of apartments. You see,
Denver and Seattle are the two city major cities in America outside of New York City. But Denver and Seattle build a lot of housing. They are the most pro-housing cities in America.
And some of it's affordable housing in Denver, right?
Yes. Did you go to the Five Points neighborhood?
Know it well.
Because I would say that was probably an acorn stronghold.
Our office used to be right there.
Okay, heavily African-American. Right. I mentioned this in the book. Heavily African-American neighborhood declared a blighted area, and 5 years after it declared a blighted area, it's been gentrified, and the African-American population has sharply been reduced. That's why I say people listening to the show might think, wait, my neighborhood is, my city is safe. Check a look what happened to Five Points and Highland Park, and you got to prepare for this because sitting still and not acquiring land is not the right way to go, as you know from Five Points.
And so the building, though, still, I mean, Denver is a big city, so there is building, though, in some of the old neighborhoods, right? I mean, not the old neighborhoods, but some neighborhoods, like particularly across the expressway and the old Latino area.
So. Yeah, Denver's doing a better job than other cities, without question. And nearby Boulder, which I write about in the book, is like trying to be an elitist enclave, even though it's a college town. So it's a really tough, you know, Denver is the exception to the cities of this country.
And Boulder is another one of those, you know, hippy-dippy, we're the most progressive anywhere, you know, from the, you know, Mississippi River until you get to the Pacific cities. And, you know, it's... this is why we're organizing and not politicians, because it is a head-scratcher. But it sounds like as you've moved the book around, you've gotten good reception from some places. Are you thinking that we're seeing some people start to open their
eyes? Yeah, I
think
we're seeing a lot. There's stuff going on in so many of the cities. Portland, I mean, in Minneapolis in December did get rid of exclusionary zoning, so they're going to allow apartments in every neighborhood, and that same thing's going to happen in Portland by this summer, and Seattle's doing increased density. Even Los Angeles, which has been notorious for just the most anti-apartment city in the country, homeowner groups just... Mike Davis, I referred to the people living off Sunset as the Sunset Bolsheviks because they were so adamant to meant any apartments anywhere near them. They're even against granny flats. I mean, you know, just anything that adds, that lets a renter, even L.A., is starting to build because they have such a bad homeless crisis and an affordable housing crisis. Even they are finally relenting and allowing low-income housing to be built.
And you mentioned Mike there. He's obviously supports your position.
Oh, yeah, he has a great chapter that I quote from in his book about just these, he calls them the Sunset Bolsheviks, these people living up in Bel Air.
Term. I got you. I'm slow on the uptake because...
Yeah, you know, these
books
really...
keep right on the shelf near you. Those are classics. Randy,
yeah,
people get a copy of your book, Generation...
Well, it's, you know, they can get it in bookstores available online. People wanting to learn more can go to my website, generationpricedout.com, and I'm always on Twitter, @BeyondCron, CHRON, if you want to follow housing news from around the country and keep up with what I'm doing.
And if they want to send you email or questions, is that the best way?
Yes, that's totally... They could send me an email at randy@thclinic.org. That's randy@thclinic.org.
Generation Priced. If you want to still be able to live in a city, get this book and join us in the fight. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Till next week when we'll have another guest. This is Wade Rathke from Wade's World. Thank you, Randy. We'll be with you soon.
Wade, you know, I have to say, I never knew you had a connection to Austin. So
well, there you go. And a million other cities. Okay.
Okay, take it
easy. Here
we
go.
Bye-bye.
Back to you. Thank you.
Bye.
This program is produced by WAMF 90.3 FM in New Orleans, Louisiana, and distributed by Affiliated Media Foundation Movement to our sister stations WDSV 91.9 FM in Greenville, Mississippi, and KABF 88.3 FM in Little Rock, Arkansas. For more information, please visit our website at affiliatedmediamovement.org.